Parole de Dieu afin que nous soyons capables non seulement comprendre la parole, mais faire bon Dieu plaisir. Parce que raison d'existence, non, c'est pour nous faire bon Dieu plaisir. Belle gloire en tant que créateur, belle gloire en tant que papa, belle gloire en tant que sauveur, belle gloire en tant que protecteur. Et bon Dieu, c'est tout dans la vie, non. Et c'est exactement la raison ça qui fait le créer nous pour nous balayer honneur et gloire que lui-même seul mérite. Et c'est malheureux pour nous comment les hommes traitent bon Dieu, malgré bonté que bon Dieu gagne envers nous, manifester bonté chaque jour. Si nous prenons des circonstances qui pas acceptable ou bien qui fait nous souffrir, c'est nous-mêmes. Problème personne d'autre que nous-mêmes. C'est à cause de comportement, nous, à cause de l'agissement, nous, à cause de ça, nous fait. Maintenant, puisque nous devons aller dans la prière, pour l'Esprit Saint capable d'aider nous à comprendre et partager avec les autres, nous. Mandez, s'il vous plaît, pour nous capables de plier et rentrer dans la prière ensemble avec nous. Bon, étant le Père Céleste, en divers, Céleste, comptez avec nous tout au cours de cette journée. Nous avons fait mouvement personnel, non, et nous sommes là pour protéger nous malgré mauvaises intentions, malgré. Et sorti dans le principe, dans le règlement, dans l'ordonnance, Seigneur, nous violons par la pensée, par l'action et par toute autre forme. Nous demandons au souverain pour capable intervenir dans la vie, non, afin que tout ça que nous avons fait là, dans le moment que nous avons passé là, est capable d'un bénéfice pour le monde entier, ainsi que serviteur capable. Prends contrôle de tout ce qu'on fait là. Nous prions au nom de Jésus. Serviteur, c'est pasteur Jean-Louis qui est micro la voix de la vérité, que nous existons dans North Carolina, Charlotte, et nous Everyday attending chaque soir, à la vérité, ce n'est pas tous les soirs qu'on va prendre des serviteurs, mais parce que nous gagnons une équipe qui est bien formée pour capable faire ça, nous gagnons pour nous faire. Et on va prendre des from time to time afin que nous capables d'arriver à une conviction telle que nous devons faire. Parce que nous sommes capables pour nous arriver à l'unité parfaite. Parce que c'est une recommandation de Dieu, il faut que nous arrivions à s'enrôler et en commun accord dans le Seigneur. Et hier soir, nous avons étudié le pouvoir de l'Esprit Saint. Côté que nous avons passé dans tout verset et oui, que nous montrons côté que l'Esprit Saint. Premièrement, soit avant, nous avons parlé de la promesse, l'Esprit Saint venait manifester lié sur les disciples à la Pentecôte. Maintenant, pour voir quelqu'un, lorsque le manifesté, il était fait parler en langue, 3000 âmes devinées à la conversion, dans le next meeting, 2000 âmes venues à la conversion. Donc, c'est par la puissance de l'Esprit Saint, il est arrivé à faire deux coquins miracles dans deux seulement rencontres. Maintenant, nous voulons parler de qui ça que nous est-il, qui ça que nous y est pour mon Dieu et devant mon Dieu. Et sujet à soi, votre corps est le temple de Dieu. Qui ça nous dit? Votre corps est le temple de Dieu. Pour lui, vous êtes le temple de Dieu. Vous êtes le temple de Dieu. Tout le monde connaît ça, ça y est, un temple, parce que tout le monde qui est sur la terre, qu'on allait dans un temple, quelle que soit la forme de temple, hein, et il connaît ça, ça y est, un temple. C'est un lieu de rendez-vous. Bayon on caille. C'est un lieu de rendez-vous que les chrétiens gagnent pour y rencontrer ensemble, dans un même esprit. Et nous sommes capables de dire qu'il y a plusieurs temples. Il y a un temple baptiste, il y a un temple adventiste, il y a un temple hindou, bien temple vaudou, gagner toute qualité temple. Mais puisque le ciel fait une déclaration et non pas qu'à l'autre qualité temple. Maintenant, s'il dit vous êtes le temple de Dieu et ma demeure, ça, ça veut dire. Ça tout simplement veut dire que mettez bon Dieu dans la pensée at all the time. Jour et nuit, bon Dieu doit toujours dans la pensée afin que ou pas de place pour l'autre qualité mauvaise pensée rentrer et faire travail et distancer de Dieu. Et c'est ça que Jésus-Christ dit pour prier sans cesse, parce que ça a mis en relation constante avec mon Dieu, pensée à occuper par la pensée de Dieu, par les actions de Dieu. Et tout ça qui concerne mon Dieu, c'est yo ou ap ka penser, c'est yo ou ap ka rêver, et c'est yo ap essayer de faire action selon pensée et relation qu'on a avec mon Dieu. Lorsque on dit vous êtes le temple de Dieu, c'est dans la pensée qui semble réaliser pour mon Dieu. Est-ce que vous avez place pour lui pour l'habiter dans le cœur? Cœur, c'est dans la pensée, parce que c'est lui qui est moteur de tout mauvais acte et de toute bonne action, tout, parce que l'homme parlait de réaliser un bagage, c'est dans la pensée que le sorti. On dit, ah, mon pensée était le bagage. Maintenant, si vous pensez le Dieu comme temple, c'est-à-dire, nous te disons déjà, la propriété pour vous bien songer, ou c'est un monde qui préoccupe des affaires de Dieu, ou c'est un monde que pensons sur la pensée de Dieu, ou c'est un monde qui a make sure que vous avez une bonne relation avec mon Dieu, ou pas faire aucune mauvaise action avec corps, ou pas faire aucune mauvaise action dans le pensée, parce que vous connaissez que vous êtes temple de Dieu. Vous connaissez très bien que vous êtes temple de Dieu, et c'est comme ça, vous avez toujours fait baisse pour mon Dieu capable d'habiter dans le pensée. Lorsque l'on dit vous êtes le temple de Dieu, ça ne veut pas dire que vous êtes une maison. Quand vous êtes l'église baptiste, quand vous. Non. C'est dans l'esprit, ce n'est pas la pensée, parce que bon Dieu, Dieu est esprit, dit Jésus. Il faut que ceux qui l'adorent, l'adorent en esprit. mais de nos si bon Dieu c'est un esprit que lier et formulation de l'esprit c'est dans la pensée que lier nous gagnons toute opportunité pour nous parler de Dieu dans pensée nous et qu'aimer bon Dieu dans pensée nous tout le temps et c'est une opportunité barbe moustache nous gagnons pour ne pas faire ni penser les mauvaises choses parce que nous connaissons nous gagnons une obligation pour nous qu'aimer le temple de Dieu pur pour nous qu'aimer le temple de Dieu en bonne santé pour nous capables toujours en relation avec mon Dieu et bénéficier de ses promesses. Maintenant, qui compte nous rejoindre sa parler? Lorsque nous regardons dans 1 Corinthiens chapitre 6, le verset 19, nous regardons là. 1 Corinthiens chapitre 6, 1 Corinthiens 6, le verset 19, nous allons regarder pour nous en bagaille. 1 Corinthiens chapitre 6, le verset 19. En Corinthiens 6, le 19e verset. Mais qui ça dit? Quel rapport y a-t-il entre le temple de Dieu et les idoles? Car nous sommes le temple de Dieu, du Dieu vivant. N'apprenez-vous. Quel rapport? En Corinthiens chapitre 6, le verset 19, le verset 16, pardon. Quel rapport y a-t-il entre le temple de Dieu et les idoles? Car nous sommes le temple du Dieu vivant. Comme Dieu l'a dit, j'habiterai et je marcherai au milieu d'eux. Je serai leur Dieu et ils seront mon peuple. C'est pourquoi sortez du milieu d'eux, moi l'autre. Si ou c'est le temple de Dieu, ou gagnez une préoccupation pour conserver le temple de Dieu en bonne santé spirituel. Ou pas gagne à quel rapport sérieux, à quel rapport étroit, sur une forme ou bien sur une autre, avec les autres peuples, les infidèles, qui pas connaissent mon Dieu, qui ont respecté mon Dieu toute la journée, toute la nuit, et qui ont dit même pas même que mon Dieu. Donc, c'est pas une catégorie de monde qu'on doit prendre contact avec eux, sinon, pour dire que bon Dieu, il existe, il est réel, il est vrai et il qu'on agit. La raison qui fait ou doué écarter le peuple là qui pas contre mon Dieu parce que penser à travers. Penser au sale, penser au mauvais et toute qualité acte ou bien tendance pour faire non pensé à calculer non pensé c'est bagage qui vous déplaît bon Dieu. C'est bagage qui vous sépare de Dieu. Et c'est ça qui fait les dit dans 1 Corinthiens chapitre 6 le verset 19. 1 Corinthiens chapitre 6 le verset 19, vous êtes le temple de Dieu. Quel rapport y a-t-il entre le peuple de Dieu et les idoles? Parce que si on dit mon c'est petit bon Dieu, ou pas qu'à un affaire avec mon corps, sans une forme ou bien sans une violence, ou bien n'importe qui a dit la bonne aventure, qui on gars, sans une forme ou bien sans l'autre, ou pas qu'à rien à revoir avec eux. On a dit nous avons un macoute, un grand péristyle, un malfaiteur, tout cas de bagaille. Maintenant, genre de monde, pensez-vous emprisonné. yo pagué absolument rien de bon que yo capable de dire. Ça yo cap tout bagay que yo gagne, comme pour vous dire, d'où des bagay qui vous font douter de monde qui n'a entouré pour une tendance. Là, yo, ou bien pour une tendance, prends précaution avec des monde que vous te conduit bien, ou bien vous êtes suspect. Et c'est tout ça, Satan, employé pour être capable de séparer ou de Dieu. Là. Et c'est pour être ça, l'Éternel dit encore quel rapport y a-t-il entre vous qui est le temple de Dieu et l'autre peuple-là qui n'a idole. Maintenant, nous gagnons pour responsabilité, chers frères et sœurs, pour nous conserver comme nous en bonne santé spirituelle, de façon pour nous capables toujours, amen, toujours gagner un temple qui est propre. Que mon Dieu est capable d'habiter là-dedans, qui est notre pensée. Maintenant, et lorsque nous regardons l'autre verset, nous regardons l'autre verset qui parlait sous même lignée, mais utilisait différents mots. On va regarder dans 1 Corinthiens 3, verset 16. 1 Corinthiens 3, le 16e verset. 1 Corinthiens, chapitre 3. 1 Corinthiens, chapitre 3. 1 Corinthiens, chapitre 3. 1 Corinthiens, chapitre 3, le 16e verset. Qui dit nous, ne savez-vous pas que vous êtes le temple de Dieu et que l'Esprit de Dieu habite en vous? Ne savez-vous pas que vous êtes le temple de Dieu? Quel privilège! Quel privilège que le monde rejeté à 99,9%. Le monde rejeté est une opportunité si riche, si noble. Si noble. Vous êtes le temple de Dieu, vous avez habité en vous. Ça, c'est une manière extraordinaire. Et que le monde n'a pas de valeur parce que il n'a pas gagné l'argent là-dedans. S'il te parlait de l'argent, le monde t'a embrassé. Mais puisque si il pas gagné un genre de bail ça, et le monde pas intéressé, mais néanmoins, Mabdou, si vous êtes intelligent, si vous comprenez les choses de Dieu, vous t'a embrassé parce que richesse que bon Dieu va là, elle dure pour longtemps. Et sans chercher un nom, dit que vous t'a gagné une richesse. Et beaucoup de Satan, mais rappelons bien que Satan va gagner une richesse. Tout ça qui est sur la terre, et c'est pour mon Dieu lié, inclus Satan. Inclus Satan. Satan va poser pas mes têtes. Satan, sous la domination de Dieu, parce que Dieu seul est souverain et Dieu seul est Seigneur. Et le Seigneur sur toute la terre. Satan vient vous le faire bec à terre lorsque le voit, présence de Dieu, il le fait déjà. Il te dit à Jésus, pas une persécuter ma valeur. C'est pour vous montrer que Satan connaît que l'Igon-le pour lui disparaître sur la face de la terre. Et ou même là où c'est une opportunité, bas mes moustaches, vous êtes le temple de Dieu. Maintenant, ça pour nous faire, pour nous capables de conserver une relation avec Dieu, il faut que nous restions en pire relation avec bon Dieu, en bonne relation avec bon Dieu, en bonne relation spirituelle avec bon Dieu, deux façons pour nous capables de rester en parfaite santé spirituelle, deux façons pour nous capables toujours dans l'amitié de Dieu. Donc, chers frères et sœurs, nous prenons l'ouvrir le téléphone. Et le numéro A, c'est 704-234-98-49 et 82-49. 704-234-82-49. Donc, on a simplement joué une petite musique et préparons pour aller.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Maintenant, on regarde un dernier verset que nous avons pour assurer. Hein? Et concernant et position, nous, bon côté bon Dieu, qui ça, bon Dieu, fait le nom. Et nous te répétons tout au cours du moment que nous avons passé. Mais hein? Dis-nous que nous sommes temple et là, dans nous, nous habitons. Il est habité dans penser nous. Mais néanmoins, il faut que penser à clean. Il faut que penser à propre. Il faut que penser à Dieu toujours dans ce qui est bon et non penser ce qui est mal. Nous allons regarder le dernier verset qui dit nous dans 2 Corinthiens chapitre 6, le 16e verset. 2 Corinthiens chapitre 6. Le 16e verset. Et nous prenons le soin pour nous commencer au 14e verset. Ne vous mettez pas avec les infidèles sous un joug étranger. Ça veut dire. Ça veut dire. Jésus-Christ, nous sommes bien ça, je dis. Prenez sur vous mon joug, car bonjour, est facile et léger. Ça veut dire que nous gagnons des responsabilités que nous prenons en sens contraire à la voix de Dieu, à la volonté de Dieu, qui peut être lourd et qui gagne des conséquences néfastes dans la vie, nous, et qui éloigne nous chaque jour loin de Dieu. Loin de Dieu. Et loin de Dieu. On ne peut même rendre compte à quelle distance qu'on y est de rivage là, lorsque le courant marin a porté tranquillement. Et c'est une force tranquille ou pas qu'à lutter contre lui. Sinon, il faut que vous gagniez un moyen de sauvetage. Si jamais vous êtes tombé dans une situation pareille, pour vous avez un moyen de sauvetage. Mais il est toujours bon pour ne pas tomber là-dedans. Si vous tombez dans un courant marin, ce n'est pas vous qui mettez tout là, la, vous gagnez un bon Dieu qui vous retire là-dedans avec facilité. Et tout le monde qui connaît dans la mer connaît ça m'a dit à la. On fait deux trois bras, on regarde bien loin, on va voir qui est là. Simplement, courir marin, moto, l'aller bien loin avec vous. Mais souvent qu'on nage, ou bien souvent qu'on a une chambre de sauvetage pour goudier, forcer sortir dans le courant, on dit, l'on regarde, si c'est pas le Brésil, l'on regarde, on va la gota. Donc, bon Dieu peut être capable avec nous. Pour sauver nous. Il va nous tous les outils que nous avons besoin avec un sang sous lit, la vie éternelle en Jésus. Nous reprenons parce que nous allons terminer. Ne vous mettez pas avec les infidèles sous un joug étranger. Il dit ça, ne vous mettez pas avec les nations étrangères parce qu'il y a maintenant une idolâtrie. Car quel rapport y a-t-il entre la justice et l'iniquité? Ou qui a-t-il le commun entre la lumière et les ténèbres? Non pas matcher. Non pas matcher. Nous pas penser même bien. Nous pas agir même bien. Nous pas marcher même bien. Nous pas courir même bien. Nous pas chiter même bien. Nous pas garder même rien, pas gagner de commun entre nous, parce que nous sommes fidèles, et nous-mêmes nous sommes fidèles. Et nous sommes les ténèbres, et nous-mêmes nous c'est la lumière. C'est deux bagailles qui pas aller dans le même sens. Donc, depuis où disposez-vous quitter les ténèbres à l'avant, lumière l'avait d'un pical vertical jusqu'à ce qu'on plonge complètement dans les ténèbres. Donc, plonger complètement dans les ténèbres, Satan pose ses dents, il fait ça. Quel accord y a-t-il entre Christ et Bélial? Ou quel rapport? Quel pas a le fidèle avec l'infidèle? Quel rapport y a-t-il entre le temple de Dieu et le temple des idoles? Car nous sommes le temple de Dieu, du Dieu vivant, et comme Dieu l'a dit, j'habiterai, encore répété, j'habiterai au milieu d'eux, je serai leur Dieu et ils seront mon peuple. C'est pourquoi, encore une fois répété, sortez du milieu d'eux. C'est malheureux pour nous voir comment que les chrétiens remettent compagnie mondaine. Et ils participent dans tout et l'engagent dans toute vieille conversation malsaine que le monde a pris plaisir là-dedans. Et ils ont même pris le feel good là-dedans. Mais plus le temple de Dieu offert au Marcel. Bagadine, temple, bon Dieu. Pour vous, c'est un bail comme ça que pour vos plaisirs. C'est inacceptable. Vous déconnectez automatiquement Dieu, le Saint-Esprit de Dieu disparaît par la caillou. Nous espérons qu'on comprenne. Nous espérons que vous t'avez. Et vous changez la vie. Nous allons. Nous espérons que vous êtes capable de passer une bonne nuit sous les regards de Dieu. En attendant, pour nous capables de vous rencontrer encore, jusqu'à demain soir, nous souhaiterions une bonne soirée dans le Seigneur.
Thank you. Nevertheless, I will naturally continue to resist the demands and respect your wishes.
He would have thought it's right, they're going to bring Thompson back. What does he do? He actually save chunks of skin, mainly through pressure from the Queen. After the Battle of Isandlwana, the few British survivors tried to save their own skins as a desperate chase began.
As soon as it became clear that everything was going horribly wrong, they tried to get away to escape across country, and there was just a little gap between the Zulu horns, and they were spilled out across the very rugged country behind Isandlwana in this wild and desperate fight for freedom.
Our flight I shall never forget. No path to the crack boulders everywhere. Only wells, man and beast, were infected with the danger. Corn now in some dry torn beds, now weaving out amongst trees. So that unless you made the best use of your eyes, you were in constant danger of colliding against something. One riderless horse that ran up alongside of me I caught and gave to a poor soldier struggling along on foot. But he scarcely mounted before he was knocked off by a Zulu bullet.
This flight was an ignominious rout, but his chancellor began to rewrite history. Heroes from that humiliating day suddenly emerged.
The greatest heroes of the Battle of Isandlwana were Lieutenants Coghill and Melville of the 24th Regiment. And the reason they've been considered such great heroes is because they were trying to save the Queen's colour. They died in the act. They actually came down from Isandlwana battlefield up yonder, down that valley, crossed over the river, and were caught by Zulus on this side of the river and killed. And of course, the Queen got very involved in the story because they were trying to save her colour. They were awarded posthumous VCs. But you have to ask yourself, did they really deserve them? I mean, after all, they were only fleeing the site of battle. Some might even suggest that they took the colour with them as an excuse. And it was Wolsey himself, Chancellor's successor in South Africa, who later said, "It is monstrous making heroes of those who try to save their skins by bolting."
Meanwhile, Lord Chelmsford, still at the head of the army, was urgently bringing all the evidence which could be used against him. He propagated the myth that a shortage of ammunition led to defeat of Isandlwana, ensured that potential witnesses to his errors were unable to speak out, and most significantly, tried to push the blame for defeat onto a Colonel Durnford, now dead, claiming that Durnford had disobeyed orders to save troops at Isandlwana.
The truth is, no orders were ever given to Durnford to take command. We know this because the actual order that was sent to him was later found. It was suppressed for a while, but when it eventually came out, it proved that Durnford hadn't been given those orders.
By May, as public feeling against Lord Chelmsford grew, Disraeli realized that his continuing support for the malign general might wreck his own political career.
Ultimately, Disraeli has to take the decision to cast him adrift. But when he does so, this is the cause of a major dispute between him and the Queen, because I think she's pretty much felt convinced that Disraeli's on her side. And then all of a sudden, after a series of cabinet meetings, he tells her that no, they're going to have to recall Chelmsford. And this is a major shock for her. And it's the beginning of one of the few really serious disagreements they have during their relationship. Well, the first indication that the Queen gets comes in a telegram, and it reads, "For the third consecutive cabinet meeting, we've been closeted on the affairs of South Africa.
The cabinet is of the opinion that the civil and military commands be changed and that Lord Chelmsford be recalled. And as time is precious, I hope Your Majesty will feel able to give your gracious approval to these arrangements."
"The proposed arrangement is absolutely necessary. I will not withhold any sanction, though I cannot approve it. So far, I have avoided mentioning how greatly startled and much annoyed I was at this decision, Mr. Disraeli, announced before I given my consent."
"It is most painful, Your Majesty, for me to differ with Your Majesty in any view of public affairs. However, this unhappily precipitated war, for which I blame Chelmsford, has produced serious consequences for this country. Had it not been for this war, Your Majesty by now would have been dictatorial in Europe."
"This may be true, but I cannot believe Lord Chelmsford would have acted unless absolutely necessary. It is my wish that on his return you should receive him and hear everything from his own lips. A few kind words to the general would soothe and gratify."
"I very much regret, Your Majesty, that I hold to my view that He invaded Zululand without adequate knowledge of the country, with no precaution and no preparation. He violated every principle of warfare, and I think it's entirely unbecoming of me to receive it.
On July 29, 1879, Chelmsford was returning to London, and to a queen whose belief in him was starting to falter.
As Queen Victoria fed more and more information by the cabinet, by Disraeli, she's gradually coming around to the fact that maybe Chelmsford isn't as competent as she suspected. She effectively loses her faith in him for a time. When Chelmsford finally comes back to Britain after his recall, she grants him an audience. She gives him a chance to explain himself, and Chelmsford is clever enough, wily enough, and greasy enough to convince the Queen that she was wrong to change her opinion and that actually he had no responsibility for Islam honor after all.
Lord Chelmsford, the Zulu Shield is a most thoughtful gift, particularly at a time when you have so many pressing concerns.
I'm glad to please you, Your Majesty.
You were telling me of Isantwana.
Yes, indeed. With regard to that man, there is no doubt that Colonel Chelmsford disobeyed orders in leaving the flat as he did. I myself knew nothing of what was happening, since he sent a messenger to say he was in danger. Still, I cannot attack dead men.
It's clear to me, Lord Chelmsford, it was not your fault, but that of others, that this surprise at Isantwana took place. I merely hope that you can prove how unjust people have been towards you. You've been blamed by many, and even by the government, for commencing a war without sufficient cause.
Ma'am, I do believe the war was quite inevitable. Had we not acted when we did, we should ourselves have been attacked. Now, it is true that I underestimated the strength of the Zulu. The intelligence I received indicated a force of 20,000 men, whereas, in fact, we were closer to 60,000.
But it seems to me that the opposition led by Mr. Gladstone and the press have done much harm in pronouncing judgment on what they neither know nor fully understand.
What Chelmsford says to Queen Victoria in defense of his responsibility for Isantwana is a pack of lies. I mean, he tells her that there were probably 60,000 Zulus rather than only 20,000. Well, complete nonsense. There were only 20,000 at Isantwana. He tells her that although he doesn't want to malign the names and reputations of dead men, and he, of course, is referring to Durnford, that Durnford has effectively disobeyed an order, and that's probably the key reason why Isantwana happens. Again, it's complete nonsense.
I'm most grateful to Your Majesty for your gracious support, which has lifted a very heavy heart. I have no desire to cast aspersions on Mr. Disraeli, but reluctant though I am to say it, I suspect he was the one who insisted on my recall.
He was greatly disappointed and irritated by the war, and I feel he has been rather unjust towards you. I do feel that he makes no allowance for the difficulty of the South African campaigns.
I'm afraid, ma'am, that his refusal to meet with me denies me the opportunity to correct his misapprehensions.
I do believe it would be too severe of Mr. Disraeli to persist, but I am confident that he may change his mind.
Having escaped responsibility for the shameful defeat at Isantwana, Lord Chelmsford was halfway home in whitewashing our image of that bloody day. But he had yet to manufacture a happy end. p.m., January the 22nd, and the episode which would provide Chelmsford's redemption was about to unfold. Fired up by victory at Isantwana, a small breakaway band of Zulus spontaneously moved to attack a supply depot of British-controlled Natal, bordering on Zululand. It was called Rorke's Drift, a name which, for many, symbolizes the Zulu War. And when they found themselves pursuing the fugitives down to the border over there, they suddenly realized that the whole of the British border, this great sort of circle of hills in the background here, was largely unprotected. And here was a great opportunity just to nip across the river and see what goodies were awaiting them on the other side.
Everything was perfectly quiet at Rorke's Drift. Not a soul suspected it was only a dozen miles away. The very men that we had said goodbye and good luck to were either dead or in our last fierce fight with the Zulus.
Barometer, The sentries report Zulus to the southwest. Thousands of
at Rorke's Drift, a garrison of 130 men held out against nearly 3,000 Zulus, a legend which the film Zulu has cemented.
It's a miracle. It's absolutely amazing, but yes, the feeling that comes across you of standing where one of your ancestors stood, having 10 yards.
Today, this battle still fires the imagination of those descended from the men who fought here.
Right. You know, they were pretty close, and of course that was just a dead spot around there, so nobody knew what was going on just on that corner. My great-grandfather, Sergeant Henry Gallagher, was here as the senior sergeant at Rorke's Drift. He saw the Zulus first coming over, and he told my father that when he first saw them coming across, that he was absolutely terrified, and that he shouted out to Bromhead from that wall, "Here they come, as thick as grass and as black as thunder."
And the great-great-grandson of Private William Jones, PC, he defended part of the hospital at Rorke's Drift. This was a small island of men in a sea of Zulus. There was nowhere else to go. There was nothing left to do but fight. William will have heard the screams, will have heard dying screams, and of course the feeling that they were next. It must have been an awful experience. William would have been just behind us here, you know, to be so close to where he was, you know, in the same place. Incredible. But of course, yours was only just round the corner.
And they must have been talking to each other at the time, must have
been. They were so clean shouting.
They were so close. Just round the corner here, of course, is where Henry was. And can you just imagine the feeling that Henry must have had, and that when he gave out the shout, when he actually saw the Zulus coming straight down through there at him.
Yes.
I mean, no wonder the guy said he was frightened.
Yeah, well, along the wall here, there was just the one window, about 8 feet off the ground, and of course, it was already starting to go dark. The roof was already on fire. They got the wounded out of there, they got themselves out of there.
But of course, that's the time when Henry was helping to give covering fire to William and helping him through.
And of course, they experienced most of that night inside this redoubt.
But can you imagine, John, there's 130 odd people in this tiny, tiny little space.
Yeah.
How tight they must have been together and how hot the feeling must have been from even just bodily heat.
Absolutely.
And of course, a pile of Zulus lying in the ground just in front of him.
The defense of Rorke's Drift was undeniably heroic. But how did this skirmish, involving around a tenth of the numbers who fought at Isandlwana, come to dwarf the far larger battle in the British psyche?
The more significant battle is at Isandlwana. That was when the course of the future of this war was actually decided. And by elevating the strategic significance of the action at Rorke's Drift and giving it a meaning in terms of the wider war, which it doesn't really possess, this to some extent wipes out some of the stain of the very real disaster, the real defeat here at Isandlwana earlier in the day.
We as Zulus felt a bit distracted from the importance of Isandlwana, whereas it was a Zulu victory, because Isandlwana was more important for the Zulu people as much as it still is even for generations of Zulus like us who are living in this time.
In contrast to the widely lamented disemboweling of British dead by Zulus, the ruthless execution after the battle of nearly 500 wounded Zulus by the British remained in. Rorke's Drift, as it seems, had to produce untainted heroes.
Well, of course, the official heroes of Rorke's Drift were the two officers, Chard and Bromhead. Chard, played by Stanley Baker in the film, and Bromhead, played by Michael Caine. The truth is probably slightly different. I suspect that the British public and maybe even the authorities needed two well-bred officers at the head of this extraordinary action. and certainly it was important for Chelmsford himself in trying to diminish the effect of Islamwana. Many of the people in the British Army shortly after the announcement of the VC came out were astonished that these two men had won the VC. One man described Bromhead as a stupid old fellow and as deaf as a post, and another officer described Chard as hopelessly stupid and incapable of even the most menial task.
Queen Victoria's Journal, on the other hand, recorded a rather more favourable estimation of this famously inarticulate soldier.
I dined with Major Chard last night. He's such a nice, quiet young man.
Quite charming, I'm sure, Your Majesty.
Gave a fascinating account of what seemed to me a brilliant defence of Rorke's Drift.
Oh, there is no doubt about the valour of our troops. They have shown the utmost devotion and bravery.
Seems that people should take more pride in such a memorable victory instead of bemoaning the tragedy of Isandlwana.
I'm entirely of Your Majesty's opinion that the British people should dwell as little as possible upon the appalling events at Isandlwana. Far better.
I don't think there's any doubt that the action of Rorke's Drift, which also took place on the same day as Isandlwana, was a manna from heaven, both for the military authorities in South Africa, but also for the politicians in Britain.
I think it is a very sad state of affairs to be concentrating on such events. But one of the proudest moments in the history of the British Empire has occurred with the heroic defense of Rorke's Drift. I am sure the recollection of those 80 men will prove that the stamina and valor of the English soldiery have not diminished.
Rorke's Drift was an action which in some ways could be used to mask and diminish the effects of Isandlwana. And I think for that reason, it gets its full treatment, both in terms of the number of Victoria Crosses that are awarded, the number of times it's mentioned in Parliament, and the number of times the press pick up on the story.
In what represents a spectacular piece of spin, 11 Victoria Crosses were given to the saviours of Rorke's Drift, more than any other single engagement in British history. Only one was awarded for D-Day. Furthermore, it may be questioned whether praise was showered on the heads of the right men.
The truth of the matter is that the real hero was ignored for a long time. His name was Commissary James Dalton. And there's strong evidence that Dalton takes command at a very early stage from Bromhead and Charles. He certainly convinces them to stay at Rorke's Drift when their first instinct is actually to do a runner when they hear about the news of Isandlwana. He makes them stay, and he also insists and arranges the defence. The point about Dalton is he's not from the right background.
The British government dragged its feet for a year, finally awarding Dalton a VC when the celebrations had died down. But Dalton was only one of the less well-bred heroes of Rorke's Drift who was sidelined while honours were showered on the less deserving officers.
My great-grandfather, Sergeant Henry Gallagher, actually met the first attack. He was defending by the hospital wall with a number of troops on that wall, and he was leading and in control of those. But he didn't get a Victoria Cross, and I very much feel that it is time that Henry Gallagher, who was the senior sergeant at Rorke's Drift, was recognised. I think the situation with the Victoria Cross is as political. I also think that there wasn't a great deal of thought given to it. I think that they were just handed out.
Even those ordinary soldiers who did get a Victoria Cross were abandoned after the media circus had moved on.
William ended up selling his Victoria Cross in order to feed and clothe and look after his family. This experience revisited him in an awful way. Towards the end, he was found wandering in Manchester. He had run out of his daughter's house, screaming that the Zulus were coming to get him, and ended his days in the workhouse.
Many of the lower rank VC winners from Rorke's Drift suffered similar trauma, including the friend of William Jones, Robert Jones. During a period of madness, he shot himself in his back garden whilst chasing imaginary Zulus. Queen Victoria, meanwhile, was still working for the public rehabilitation that Chelmsford's good breeding merited.
My dear Mr. Disraeli, for some time now, who have determined against receiving poor Lord Chelmsford, even though, as you know, it is the custom for the Commander-in-Chief of any army to be received by the Prime Minister on his return home. While I do not pretend that Lord Chelmsford has made no mistakes, he has suffered cruelly from the abuse heaped upon him. A short interview with yourself would allow him to lay the facts before you. Indeed, not to meet him now would be both unkind and unjust, and I have never known you to be either. I trust that you will now do what is right, and indeed would be much grieved if you did not.
The Queen gets her way in one sense, in that Disraeli finally agrees in October, a little over a month after Chelmsford's return, to receive him, but not at his private residence. It would actually take place in Downing Street, and it was, as was reported after a formal interview, there was no sign of affection and there was no attempt to soothe, which is what Queen Victoria requested.
Power certainly has come to me too late. Once I could have moved dynasties and governments. Now I can barely protect myself from a tiny old lady.
Well, Chancellor, Prime Minister.
I am gratified that you are able to receive it, Mr. Disraeli, and I hope that you will permit me to talk to you a little of the Zulu War, as I have done to the Queen. As you know, Her Majesty has been unfailingly kind and persistent in her support of me, as is typical of her generosity.
Indeed it is. Frankly, Lord Chelmsford, now that the Zulu War is over, I see no point whatsoever in further discussions. However, as you may be aware, by acting against my wishes, you associated me with a policy that I am now compelled to defend, whatever my inclinations. In fact, this interview will be taken as confirmation that the war was begun at my instigation.
This regime's policy is pestilent. What was the crime of the Zulus? 10,000 have been slaughtered for no offense other than their attempt to defend their homes, wives, and families against the British artillery with their naked bodies. Disraeli is leading the British Empire along the road which plunges us into suffering, discredit, and dishonor.
By the end of 1879, the Zulu War had journeyed to its brutal end. Thousands more Zulus dying as civil war followed the overthrow and imprisonment of King Cetshwayo.
Their bravest men had not breath to run away, and they perished. Let me draw a veil over that last part of the scene. Such fine fellows with Herculean limbs and intelligent foreheads, broken. Chivalry ends where pursuit begins, but the British public's notion of the Zulu is their notion of all black peoples, that of the savage.
On the surface, it doesn't appear that anyone won the Zulu War. The Zulu nation was eventually dismantled, the country was broken up, and ultimately, after many years of civil war, it was actually annexed. The British Army wins no credit out of the whole campaign, and the British government, too, you could argue, loses the next election partly as a result of the Zulu War.
The Zulu King Cetshwayo, when reviewing the state of his nation in the aftermath of this, shortly before he himself died as a result of some of these conflicts, looked around and said, well, everything which was mine in Zululand has been spoilt by the British.
An unknown Zulu soldier wrote, the Zulu is tired. It shines in the eyes of all the people. The black elephant trembles to the wind while the bones of our kings are crumbling. Nothing but death conquers the white man.
It's one of the tragedies of history that there was that war, and that our people suffered. And in fact, even now, it makes our hearts sore to see how many people who really had no, we never, a snowball's chance in hell to resist, modern weapons of the British were mowed down literally like that, especially with vengeance, especially after the victory of Isandlwana. Yeah.
that Lord Chelmsford must have thanked his lucky stars, having come from his own farm, getting back to Wolf's Drift and realizing that they won Wolf's Drift. I mean, what a PR coup that is at the end of this dreadful day. Victorian spin.
By 1887, Queen Victoria was once more the darling of the British public, her jubilee a wonderful spectacle. Disraeli had lost the 1880 election and died the next year. The uncelebrated saviour of Rorke's Drift, James Dalton, died in 1887, a broken man. William Jones, along with many of the ordinary soldiers at Rorke's Drift, ended his days in poverty-stricken madness while the British abandoned the Zulus and civil war ensued.
There's no real saving grace at the end of this story. Well, there isn't even for the people who were here. Mm. I mean, there's John's forebear. I mean, he actually landed up in Polish.
Mm.
I mean, for what?
Mm.
And so that somebody can turn their backs on the nation and having left a great big mess.
But one man prospered. Queen Victoria showered honours upon Lord Chelmsford, promoting him to full general, awarding him the gold stick at court, and appointing him lieutenant of the Tower of London.
The Time Watch returns to BBC Two on Friday with a brand new series. Stay with us for the full story coming right up. Mm-hmm.